San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you from KFMB Studios with 50,000 watts of power. We're not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, LA County, up the coast of Seattle on a good night, and that's important. Keep that in mind. Down to Cabo, out to the desert, and usually my host is Richard Muzio, who is a philanthropist and an accomplished marathon runner and an author and family office expert advising several high net worth families, but he is off tonight because he had a commitment with his Oceanside Turkey Trot. Actually, we're recording this a little earlier in the week, so keep that in under your hat. But look, if you've downloaded the app for 760 KFMB, whatever store you use, you can hear us on your smartphone. And all these podcasts are heard on iymoney.com. We take out the commercials. Also at 760kfmb.com, which we stream live, and we also take out the commercials there. So, but tonight we put those in because we have sponsors who love us. So there you have it. But anyway, we've got a really terrific guest tonight. I think it's about our fourth billionaire on the show, but he's the first one that with this particular message. Although Dr. Irwin Jacobs, who you know was the founding CEO of Qualcomm, is very liberal-minded, and I believe even his custodial staff gets health care, and he treats his people very, very well, and we'll ask our guest about that. But our guest tonight is an entrepreneur and a venture capitalist. He lives in Seattle, and he's a partner with a Seattle-based firm called Second Avenue Partners, and they're in the venture capital. He has founded and managed and financed over 35 companies across a broad range of industries, including manufacturing, retailing, software, e-commerce, digital media, robotics, healthcare, and banking. And some of his notable companies have included Aquantive, which he sold to Microsoft in 2007 for only $6.4 billion, and I believe that was cash. He got in early with Amazon, and In Situ Group and his family business, Pacific Coast Feather Company, one of the world's largest manufacturers of bed pillows, comforters, and mattress pads. And he's the co-author of two books, both national bestsellers in politics, The True Patriot and The Gardens of Democracy. And he's active in a broad range of civic and philanthropic work in Washington State and nationally. And he might be best known to you for his great TED Talk he gave, Beware Plutocrats, the Pitchforks Are Coming. And then also his article on Politico. But anyway, I'd like to welcome to our show Nick Hanauer. Nick, how are you?
I'm doing well, Joe. Thank you for having me.
That's great. Our pleasure. Well, with our show, we usually like to start at the beginning, and I did read your Politico article, and actually the end is where I'd like to start because it gets into your family history a little bit and your skills is in the merchant field. But your family came from Germany, right? Immigrants?
Yeah, my dad's family did.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So obviously forced out by the turning political tide there. So obviously you turned that around and became a great success. You know, but here's the craziness, Nick. I was thinking of this on the drive over here today. But for that maniac in Germany, you know, Hitler, your family might, you know, if things had been different, your family might have stayed in Germany and, you probably would have wound up in a different field, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, for sure, my family was prosperous in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing well. They, mm-hmm. they absolutely would not have left, save that.
Mm-hmm. There you go. You were born and raised in Seattle, I take it, right?
I actually was born in New York City. My mom and dad met in New York City, but I moved to Seattle when I was 5 years old. So,
okay.
You know, it's definitely home.
Okay. So that's
which is where I live now.
Great. So that's where you went to grade school, high school, and college, right?
Yeah.
All the way through. So you went to public grade school, public high school?
Yep. I went to public schools all throughout. Then I went to the University of Washington.
There you go. So
public high school.
There you go. So you're happy with the quality of public education in Seattle up there?
No.
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 I mean, at the time.
And I've been a long-time activist in public education policy and politics. And you know, truth be told, I mean, I have no room to complain because things clearly have worked out very, very well for me.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be very hard to claim that, you know, my school experience was a great one.
Outside
of college.
Okay.
But I didn't.
So grade school and high school, you thought?
I mean, you know, I thought my high school was terrible and.
Huh. What were your main complaints? Do you think
it was a big high school, and they were just, you know, it just did not. I don't know. There just wasn't very much there that I connected with. And you know, part of that's me probably.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you know, I look at the experience my kids are having, and uh-huh. you know, it's just a much better one than I had. So who knows? In any case, you know, don't feel sorry for me. That's
oh, no,
sure.
We don't feel sorry for you. I'm just trying to, you know, identify because I went to parochial schools and, you know, I thought some things could be better. But, you know, public education, I guess it just depends what suburb or area you're in
And you know, they were limited by the money they had and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. But mm-hmm. But I'm a big advocate for public schools, and I've been involved in the politics and policy of it really for almost my whole adult life. I founded something here in Washington State called the League of Education Voters with a woman public school activist, and we've been involved in, you know, everything from, you know, trying to get more funding to schools, charter schools, you know, school reform, you know, teacher accountability, boy, you name it. We've worked on a lot of things. So.
Good. We'll drill down on that toward the end of the show because we have a lot to talk about with you. So anyway, your grandparents landed in New York and they picked up where they left off in Germany and with the pillow and comforter business. And
yeah, it's sort of a funny story. Yeah. So my grandfather and my great uncle, you know, they had this pillow business, mm-hmm. feather pillow business mm-hmm. in Germany. And when they got to the United States, they got a little bit of money out, but they looked around for a place to restart and wrote letters to all the pillow companies in the country. And there was a job available at the Pacific Coast Feather Company in Seattle, Washington. And my uncle flew out across the country to take this job, washing feathers for 50 cents an hour.
Oh, my gosh. What year was that?
In the late 1930s.
Wow, okay.
And
Depression going on in the country,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and the company went bankrupt, and my great-uncle and my grandfather bought it and sort of reinstantiated it and ran it for a very long time. And then when I was 5 years old, you know, I was growing up, I was living in New York, and my mom and dad were, you know, I guess poor.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was a waitress, and my dad, I think, was an editor somewhere, and, mm-hmm. and they decided that they should get us out of New York City and move mm-hmm. us to Seattle. And so my dad went to work for the family business at that point, in the mid-60s, I guess, and eventually took it over. And when he did, the thing really started to grow, and I started working for the family business when I was, oh my gosh, I started going down there when I was probably 7 or 8 years old, first time. But I worked for the family business summers from the time I was about, well, when I got into junior high school, probably when I was about 12, 13 years old, and all the way through high school and college.
Huh.
And then went into the business sort of full-time after college.
So you're doing just more like manual labor as a youngster.
Yeah. Well, you know, working in the factory, mm-hmm. you know.
Gotcha.
Making pillows.
Gotcha. So what did your father incorporate that really helped the business take off? Because obviously the 60s were pretty much boom years. Well, the 50s,
yeah,
50s
I mean,
for sure.
You know, the thing in the day that distinguished the pillow business mm-hmm. was how much cheating there was going on.
Ah.
the interesting thing about a pillow, of course, is you can't see what's inside.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference between a pound of down, which is what you might label it, and a pound of feathers is a difference between, you know, $1 and $30.
Huh.
And there was, in the day, a tremendous amount of cheating going on in that business. And my dad and my grandfather just refused to do it. They just they delivered what they said they were going to deliver, and we carved out this niche as a high quality, high trust producer of these products.
There you go.
And you know, it was tough sometimes because, you know, you'd be undercut by 50% on price in these circumstances. But over time, it, you know, honesty is the best policy, and it paid off. And the company got bigger. And then my dad did an incredibly smart thing, which is he hired somebody from outside the family to be the CEO of the company. So I and my brother, brother in the business, and went to work for that outsider as a CEO. And Joe, that made all the difference because family business is very tough for that, you know, family dynamic reason.
Sure. Egos and different...
Yeah, all that stuff. All that stuff, right? And but the guy that my dad hired was a wonderful, just an incredible mentor to me. And
how did he find him?
You know, he was he worked, he was the chief financial officer for a company that we did business with. And very, very smart and wonderful guy named Roy Clothier. And, and Roy was my boss and really kind of taught me everything I knew. And I was very aggressive, and we, and that business grew really fast. And it grew, you know, we were growing, you know, this is a manufacturing business in an industry which is essentially mature, and we were still growing at 30% per year, which was almost all market share gains, which is hard to do.
Well, you must have been a good marketer too, right?
Yeah. I mean,
you must have had
we did some very smart things and grew the business. I mean, the business today, we still own it. It's probably close to a $300 million company.
I would have I would have commercials with
company.
I would have kids commercials with kids having pillow fights with the real feathers flying in the air.
Exactly.
And we've got to take a break, Nick. We're going to come right back with you. So hang tight, everybody. We'll come back with billionaire Nick Hanauer right after this. Hang on.
AM 760 KFMB.
All right, we are back with billionaire Nick Hanauer, who's head of Second Avenue Partners up in Seattle, and you might know him from TED Talks. He said, beware, fellow plutocrats, the pitchforks are coming, and he had a great article also in the in Politico this past year, the pitchforks are coming for us plutocrats. Same thing, but anyway, Nick, in college you went to University of Washington, right?
I did.
And you were a philosophy major, right?
I was.
So you must have studied, I guess, other countries, and what was your focus and concentration there?
Oh, you know,
might have formed your political.
The thing I enjoyed about philosophy was it sort of taught you how to think critically and analytically, and it touched a lot of areas. So there's the philosophy of science and religion and art and,
You know, and business.
Philosophy of language and stuff like that. And I just found it very, very interesting. And, and you know, philosophy is sort of mathematics with words.
You get into the philosophy of economics a little bit in business, because obviously...
You know, I didn't, you know, I the only course, Joe, that I dropped in all of college was my economics course, my Econ 101 course. And I dropped it because a third of the way into the course, you know, they were teaching the sort of neoclassical
guns and butter and all that. And was it the
Samuelson, on and so forth.
I was just going to say, was it the Samuelson book? Because I had the same one.
And so today we can say with absolute scientific certainty that all of those ideas are not true, that there's been a revolution in our understanding of economics and people and so on and so forth. But even then, when I was in college, I thought that this, because I thought it was nonsense.
Let's debunk a couple of them right now. Which ones would you say really you want to turn on their ear?
People, the fundamental, one of the most profound fundamental assumptions of neoclassical economics is that people are rational calculators of their self-interest, and that we're all the same in that way. And that's just not true. People aren't rational at all. They're sort of approximating They're not selfish. They turn out to be strongly reciprocal. All of the neoclassical ideas rest on that assumption about what people are really like.
Remember that theory of diminishing returns where you stuff yourself with steaks and then, of course, over time?
Yeah, people are...
I only need one steak.
People are goofy. Yeah. We make goofy decisions for goofy reasons in goofy ways.
Uh-huh.
And
for sure.
That's why economies are notoriously hard to predict, right?
Uh-huh.
Economics is notoriously hard to predict because people are unpredictable.
Right.
And, markets aren't efficient. They're effective if they're well managed. And, they turn out not to be equilibrium systems. This is another one of the fundamental assumptions. They're non-equilibrium systems. And I go on and on. All I can tell you is that when I was 19 years old, even though I didn't know this stuff, what I know today, my intuition told me that all the stuff they were teaching me in that class was nonsense.
Huh.
And I just couldn't take it, so I quit the course.
Yeah, do mention, though, economies are complex ecosystems.
You're
right, with a lot of moving parts something unplanned or unforeseen can happen and throw the whole wrench in the works.
The whole thing off.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So there you have it. You worked, so after college, you went to work for the feather company, correct?
Yes. Yeah. And I worked in the family business and we grew really fast. But my dad and my boss were very, very supportive of me. And I've always had like a lot of energy and I wanted to start other companies and they were supportive of that. And so I and my friends and brothers and so on and so forth started starting other companies and, a custom picture framing company and a nightclub and a
tell me about the nightclub. You mentioned that in the article. So
a group of my buddies and I got together and we founded a nightclub called Down Under. It was a great learning experience.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, it's when you're 26 years old, it's a lot of fun to own the hottest club in town.
Okay. We'll just leave that to our imagination.
It was fun.
So you probably only let the cream of the crop in the door,
exactly.
Right? You did that your little...
It was good. It was good.
You were Studio 55.
Yeah.
Well, is that club still there, by the way, or what's there on the site now?
Oh, I can't even remember. It's long gone.
Okay.
Long gone. Those businesses don't last long. That was another lesson we learned, right? These businesses don't last long.
They're very flash in the pan, yep.
Anyway, I mean, one of the really lucky and fortunate and maybe smart things I did when I ran the pillow business was that I took a very analytical approach to the sales and marketing process, and I broke all of my retail customers up, and we sold to everybody. Every retailer in America was a possible buyer of pillows for us.
Huh.
I broke them all up into what I called strategic groups. That is to say, kinds of retailers that shared strategies. So all the wholesale clubs were together and all the mass merchandisers were together and all the grocery stores were together and all the department stores were together. And I built programs and processes for each one of those channels.
Huh.
And taking that analytical approach allowed me to understand what the actual dynamics of each retail channel were.
Uh-huh.
So when the internet came along in the early 90s, I could do some strategic math and almost no one else could.
Huh.
I could see before anyone could how big internet retail was going to be.
Uh-huh.
Because I could compare what it would be, what the dynamics of that channel would be in the future.
So you were tracking the Walmarts and everybody. You were tracking
exactly.
them all, right?
I kind of knew what was going
the
on.
Brick and mortar.
And as luck would have it, I had a friend who agreed that it was going to be huge, and his name was Jeff Bezos.
Now, how did you meet? When was that lucky day?
One of my closest girlfriends was a mathematician and had gone to work for a hedge fund in New York called D.E. Shaw, and she was dating Jeff Bezos.
Ah.
And so when I would always hang out with my buddy Ann, who now runs essentially the largest quantitative hedge fund in the world, D.E. Shaw. But she was dating Jeff. They both worked there, and she introduced us, and we became friends. And then, you know, and we both had this interest in the internet. And as luck would have it, he wanted to quit his incredibly lucrative hedge fund job and start one. And, you know, and he needed a place to start it. And for a variety of reasons, he decided to move from New York to Seattle to start Amazon.com. So he sent his stuff to my house, and he drove across the country, and off we went.
Wow. Boy, that was a very fortuitous day when you met him. Well, he's got a great sense of humor, too. Is he still laughing a lot? Because I used to love to hear him laugh when he'd get interviewed and stuff. So he's got a great sense of humor.
He does have a laugh.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
So Amazon's doing well, I take it, huh?
Well, I'm no longer involved, but a quick look at the stock price would tell you they're doing pretty well.
I know I use them a lot, so and it all did start with the books, so he must have had a little vision there. So anyway, so that you're still in touch with him, good friends, and where's he based?
Know, is he based? We see each other once in a while, but
is he based in Seattle also? Or?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Amazon Seattle.
Wow. Anyway, gosh, I got to get up there sometime because I could use a little rain, you know. It rains maybe 2 days a year down here.
Yeah.
And but you've been to San Diego, right?
Yeah, not in a while.
Yeah, good.
But it's a beautiful place.
Yeah, it's a great town. Anyway, so yeah, you got to get down here if you've seen all the sites, the zoo, SeaWorld, all that.
Oh yeah.
Okay, good.
Oh yeah.
Good. And the beaches, and in La Jolla and all that. So.
Yep.
So good. But anyway, so you met Jeff Bezos. You got in early. We're going to come back and finish the story up and get into your political philosophy after news, sports, and weather. So hang on, everybody. We'll be back with Nick Hanauer. Hang on.
Thank you.
AM 760 KFMB.
All right, we are back with the second half of the award-winning show, It's Your Money and Your Life. I'm Joe Vecchio, and my co-host Richard Musio is out tonight because he has been busy with the Oceanside Turkey Trot. But time to thank our sponsors now. We'd like to thank UBS, Michael Kwanta and Drew Freitas and their team doing some great work there based in La Jolla, and also Drew's up in Los Angeles. And also the Berkeley Research Group and Carl Sheeler, PhD. We like to thank them, evaluating businesses and improving their cash flow, doing a great job at that. Cost Segregation Initiatives and Joel Grushkin, improving cash flow for real estate and doing a great job all over the country, by the way. And he's been a guest on this show. Polito Epic, the great accounting firm up in North County. And Regions Bank, we like to thank them, and Sean Puckett, and Signature Analytics, and also Geiger Law Office, Brenda Geiger, doing great estate planning work there, and not to mention the Servant Leadership Institute and their big conference coming up next year, which Richard loves to talk about. And Richard's worked with all of them for many, many years with great success. So if you get on our website, iymoney.com, and just put your get your cursor over to the sponsor tab, there's a drop-down menu. They'll all be there for you, all their contact information, and you can get a hold of them that way. But now back to Nick Hanauer. And we left off with Jeff Bezos, and Nick wanted to make a point that he's not technically a billionaire. He's worth several hundred million, whatever it is, but he's still in the top 0.001% of the income and wealth category in this country, probably globally for that matter. Yeah. So now you came out with this. Which came out first, the Politico article or the Ted Salon talk?
Well, I've done a couple of TED Talks, but the most recent one was after the Politico article on economic inequality and so on and so forth. So,
by the way, we should say that you, Chris Anderson, did patch things up because I guess there was some controversy when you first gave this talk.
Yeah, we got in a tangle over an earlier talk that I gave about economic inequality and who the true job creators were. And that was, you know.
And they kind of censored you from the TED Talk.
Well, yeah, they did, and it was basically two dudes.
Yeah,
we just didn't. We It was a communication problem.
Right.
Just put it that way.
But then they invited you to their home office, and they buried the hatchet. He actually put it on his website.
He's a good man and a friend of mine. So he asked me back to do another TED Talk recently, which I did. So.
You had to fly all the way to New York City, right?
Yeah.
To do that? Right.
Yep.
So was that the same basic talk about the pitchforks, or is there something?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and you know the argument. My argument is that economic inequality Some economic inequality is an indispensable part of capitalism in any high functioning economy.
Mm-hmm.
But in the same way, capitalism requires some inequality in the same way that plants require some water. But mm-hmm. just like too much water drowns plants. Too much inequality will drown capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And if you let a society get too economically unequal, it will collapse,
mm-hmm.
either politically or economically. And there just aren't any examples where that hasn't happened eventually. And so everybody has a stake in trying to moderate this, in particular people like me, who always end up... doing the worst in the end in these circumstances. And so
would you say that's what happened in the Soviet Union? You know, that company, really, they had the revolution in 17 and they were done by 1989, 1990. I mean, they only lasted about 80 years. Do you think that was because of too much inequality there? Because I know those premiers were all billionaires and corruption and fraud.
They had a feudal system where a few people had everything and everybody else had nothing. And
mm-hmm.
eventually people got pissed and the shame of it is, of course, is that they replaced a terrible system with another terrible system.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you had 90 years of misery.
Yeah.
Not like Russia's, strawberries and cream today, but, we have a pretty good system in our country. And, you don't want to push things so far that people get so pissed that you replace... Well, a pretty darn good system with a terrible system.
If your production and manufacturing break down and everything breaks down and people are, obviously record levels for child poverty now and everything.
Yeah, my argument is that nobody has a stake in making sure the middle class thrives
mm-hmm.
More than the people who own the companies that sell stuff to the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And like me and other wealthy people, policies like raising the minimum wage aren't bad for capitalism. They're indispensable to it because it makes sure that every worker earns enough money both to live but also to be a good customer for every business.
Now tell us about the Seattle experience. You said the regular wage was already at $9.32, which was a 30% higher than the federal minimum wage, and now it's up to $15 an hour. Is that all over the city or just certain segments?
Yeah, so we passed I and some of my
colleagues,
pals,
mm-hmm.
Engineered the passage of a $15 minimum wage here in the city of Seattle, which by the way just passed in San Francisco and some other places,
mm-hmm.
but it passed by a lot.
Right?
It does not go in all at once. It's carefully phased in
mm-hmm.
over 3 to 7 years, depending on how big the company is.
Mm-hmm.
The largest companies have it phased in 3 years. So McDonald's and Walmart and these giant companies who can afford it go quicker. Businesses with fewer than 500 employees go slower.
Mm-hmm.
It starts in April or March,
mm-hmm.
In a couple of months, a few months. And we feel like it's going to be a wonderful policy. And the point I make in my article, I've made other places, is to be clear, Washington State already had the highest minimum wage of any state in the country at $9.32 an hour. And already had the highest rate of small business job growth in the country, in my opinion, as at least partially as a consequence of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even more than that if you look at it carefully, because in Washington State, tipped workers, right, people like work in restaurants and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
who make up a big portion of the low-wage workforce,
mm-hmm.
are paid $9.32 plus tips here versus $2.13 plus tips, which is the federal tipped worker minimum.
Oh my gosh.
So we pay 427% more to tipped workers in Seattle, Washington than they do in, you know, pick your town in Mississippi. But, you know, if this sort of traditional trickle-down view was right, that if wages went up, employment would go down, we would have no restaurants in Seattle, Washington. But I'm here to tell you, there is no city in the country that has a more booming restaurant business than Seattle.
Huh.
It's just, it's nuts.
A lot of happy
and
people walking around.
That's because, right? This really simple reason, when restaurants pay restaurant workers enough so that even they can afford to eat in restaurants, it's pretty good for the restaurant business.
Well, you mentioned Henry Ford in your article.
Yeah.
Makes sense. So.
And look, I know that when restaurant owners look at these higher wages at 15, that, you know, it makes a lot of them nervous.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, when they looked at the difference between 213 and 932, it made them nervous too.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well, they'd rather have.
You know, and yet, there isn't a place in the country where there are more restaurants or where small businesses aren't growing faster than here. And that's because, when low-wage workers earn $7.25 an hour, guess how much of that money goes to small businesses in their community?
Mm-hmm.
Zero, right? What can you afford?
Right.
A little bit of rent, maybe a bus pass, and some food from the local grocery store.
And it increases the tax base also, doesn't
it? Exactly, everything. And so, you know, my message in the Plutocrats piece and in other places is that, you know, we all have a stake in trying to moderate the amount of economic inequality in our economy,
mm-hmm.
because if it's moderate, the thing is going to work a lot better for everybody, and business is frankly going to grow faster.
Yeah. And we'll get into why. I want to know, how you arrived at it. Is it just common sense, or did you study a few books or experts at the time? So,
sure.
But we're going to come back. We have to take a little break right now. We're going to come right back with Nick Hanauer, who's worth several hundred million, not a billion quite. But we'll cut you some slack. Come on back. We'll be right back with Nick Hanauer.
AM 760 KFMB.
We're in the home stretch here with Nick Hanauer up in Seattle, and I wanted to plug this play called Enron. It opened in London, and it was on Broadway for a while, and it's playing here at the Moxie Theater out near San Diego State. It runs through December 7th. Get on their website, Moxie Theater, or even better, get the tickets half price at San Diego ArtsTix, SDArtsTix.com. I'm on the board there, and we save people a lot of money going to theater down here. But so, Nick, your revelation about, the middle out versus the trickle down, you're done with the Reaganomics and the trickle down. It doesn't work. Middle out. You mentioned in your article how these movements started like in Illinois and labor and some faraway places and then eventually trickle into, I hate to use the word trickle, get into Washington when they see enough child labor being exploited. You mentioned in the 1890s and the early 20th century, all the we didn't even have a 40-hour work week. We take so much for granted now,
Yeah.
there was no overtime back then. You just work,
nope.
All these things had to be fought for, every little thing, tooth and nail.
Yep.
But when did you get the revelation that, say, we really need to bolster our middle class? Because I agree that, like John Kennedy said, a rising tide raises all the ships. And
yep.
the more we can do that. And I forget, I was in Washington with my friend Bill and Michelle, and we're sitting in the Smithsonian, that big castle there. And I said, you know what, government should just do the most good for the most people, period.
Yeah.
Whether it's policy or however, but I guess that gets to your philosophy.
Yeah. So, this is really common sense, and something that people, Americans, have understood for a long time. But, there's a strong strain. Here's economics is largely the way in which we rationalize who gets what and why.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for as long as there's been human societies, rich people have been telling poor people that our respective positions are righteous and just.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, that used to be called divine right. Today,
mm-hmm.
we have trickle-down economics,
mm-hmm.
right? It's just the
yep.
same kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
Where I say to you, tax cuts for me will create growth, and investments in you will balloon the debt and bankrupt our great country.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just a way of saying I matter and you don't.
And then how much have the Fortune 500, have they offshored and off balance sheet and cheated on taxes
just,
and pay nothing?
This is all about power and status and
mm-hmm.
who gets what.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that, you know, the better everyone does, the better the economy does. And that's not to say we should all be paid the same or that we are the same.
Right.
But everybody should have a stake in making sure that the economy is reasonably fair and you incentivize work enough so that, like, it makes sense to go get a job.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like,
mm-hmm.
there's no point in getting a job if you can't earn enough to live. Right. It's just nuts. And
there was another TED Talk after his, I think a gentleman named Wilkinson, he's an epidemiologist,
that's right.
And he actually
on the corrosive effects that economic inequality has on society,
mm-hmm.
the way in which it, you know, it distances people and it pisses people off and it makes them crazy and all this stuff. It's well known.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, unfortunately, you've got a group of people at the very tippy top who frankly don't care about other people.
Mm-hmm.
What they won't do is say that.
Mm-hmm.
What they will say is, the better I do, the better it will be for you.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, the oldest trick in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I would pay you more, except then I'd have to lay you off. you know, I would pay higher taxes, but then I wouldn't invest in our great country. You know, like all this nonsense.
And
it's just, look, it's just not true. And, you know, ordinary Americans have a big stake in pushing back on those lies.
And look at the societal cost. You mentioned Walmart, $25 billion profit. You said if they just gave ten of those billion to, a million workers.
Yeah.
10,000
bucks more a worker.
It would have relieved a lot of costs of government and the rest of society, you know, because these people could have support themselves. So.
Right. I think the recent number is that Walmart workers cost the country about $6 billion a year in public assistance, food stamps and Medicaid and all this nonsense. Well, you know, that $27 billion in profit that Walmart is making is simply a way for them to privatize the profits and socialize the cost.
Right.
So you and I pay Walmart's wages.
Yeah.
By letting them get away with this. It's just stupid. It's both morally objectionable, but also it's just terrifically inefficient.
Yeah.
And you know, if we had a reasonable minimum wage in this country, Walmart might make a touch less money, but all of their workers would earn a living wage. Not only wouldn't need public assistance, but then those workers in turn would be good customers for the businesses in their communities,
mm-hmm.
benefiting everybody again.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
There you go.
Yeah, and it's all about seeing the economy in this sort of ecosystemic way of things being connected, right?
Yeah.
You know, if the plants are healthy, then the animals are healthy, and if the animals are healthy, the plants will be healthy.
Yeah.
And seeing it in that way allows you to connect these dots and make some pretty common sense arguments about what we should do with our economic policy.
Now, look, post World War II, the labor unions really took on a lot of clout and. Obviously, had paid their workers well, and there's, you know, there's controversy either way. But you had more consumers consuming, which is great for sales, which is great for bottom lines of a lot of businesses.
Yep.
Do you think the undermining of the labor unions in the recent history has hurt?
Absolutely, and there's simply no doubt that the demise of labor unions has led to a massive increase in economic inequality. Over the last 30 years, corporate profits as a percentage of GDP have doubled from 6% to 12% of GDP. At the same exact time, the percent of GDP devoted to wages has fallen from about 52 to 46, about the same 6 or 7%. So that's $1 trillion that went essentially from wages to profits. And what most Americans need to recognize is that those that extra $1 trillion of profit isn't profit because it needs to be or should be or has to be. It's profit because powerful people like me prefer it to be. But that $1 trillion could have been used on wages. It could have been used as discounts for consumers.
And a lot of it went to C-level salaries, too, and bonuses.
Yeah, exactly. and again, that has nothing to do with some immutable law of economics. That's just power, right? This is a negotiation between me and you.
That's true.
If I have all the power in the negotiation, I will get a lot, you will get a little. But that doesn't mean there's nothing intrinsically righteous about that or efficient or good. It's just I have power and you don't. And if you eliminate the power of workers to organize and negotiate with owners, then that's what you get.
Well, Nick, how do we get your message out there better? You have no predilection to desire to run for office at all, or?
Yeah, not really. I mean, I will tell you, my wife is violently against it.
But you've got the books coming out, and gosh,
we write books and articles and. Yeah. Try to influence the national debate.
We'll have to have you back on again and talk more about the books and as more things heat up. But we're in the home stretch here. So thank you for being our guest there, Nick. And Richard, we'll see you next week here in the studio. And thank you, Justin Hart, our sound engineer, for making us sound great. And thanks to Craig Blakeney, our con executive, and to Dave Sniff, our programming genius here at KFMB. All these podcasts are iymoney.com. We're free on iTunes also, by the way, so just search us out there. Have a good night. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye now.
AM 760 KFMB.